The Millennial Express, plowing ever onward through a northern winter. From station to station, bringing the dissident right to you.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial 2023. This is the final stream for tonight, and it is with The Distributist.
Hello.
Dave, The Distributist, has appeared on Millennial quite a few times. I don't think you've been on every single year.
No, I started late. Definitely not the first three.
Yeah, you weren't on in 15 or 16 or 17, which surprises me. But from 2018 onwards, you've been on every single year. So that's nice. Unbroken Excellent. Record.
Well, I didn't have a channel in 2015. So, you know, we were talking about what it was like, that the feeling difference between 2016 and now. I mean, it's been 7 years. It's kind of amazing how much change we've seen in this time. And, you know, that's kind of what I was hoping to talk about, is just what we've seen, the vibe shifts that we're experiencing, and what 2023 meant and what 2024 might bring about, because things are starting to feel really different. I know your frequent guest Morgoth always talks about characterizing a year by a phrase. And I don't know, he said something like the great walking away was 2023. For me, 2023 was when we really felt the vibe shift implied. And we were sensing that the new post-COVID world was emerging in 2022. In 2023, the post-COVID world is here, and we know what it looks like. And what it looks like is a very, very slowly disintegrating American empire, and then basically almost zero sincere political discourse anywhere in the mainstream. I don't know about you, but remember in 2016 when people actually talked about politics and felt like something could change? I mean, that's kind of, I mean, it's evaporated everywhere, but I would say sort of our specific sphere of things. I don't know what your feelings are.
Well, I think it's more a case of, you know, the phrase clear them out, mm-hmm. which Academic Agent popularized from Jonathan Bowden. And I don't know if he even meant a meme by it. I doubt he did, but it's certainly become a meme. That phrase means that really it's about power and an entire, species of person who is in power, the managerial elite, the technocrats, the politician, the bland, identikit politicians. Mm. It's an entire management structure that needs to be just replaced. And it's not a matter of debating issues with them. It's a matter of replacing them because their worldview is entirely foreign to ours. We don't really have common ground with them, I don't think. At least they're not, and they're certainly not going to be amenable to our worldview. So yeah. That's the way I see it, that in 2016, people still thought in those terms, including us. And therefore, that's why we discussed issues. And this actually reflects in my own behavior on Twitter, where I just don't, I mean, you still persevere debating people, Adam and Sitch. I've long since given up on this. I just thought, okay, well, we disagree. Bugger off.
Well, you know, Aaron McIntyre, right? Yes. Obviously, I think he was on Millennial. Was he on Millennial yet, or is he till this
yes,
year?
Yes,
I've been very far behind on my content this year. But he did a debate or interview with this man called Peter Burgosian yesterday, essentially, on a channel called Break the Rules. Peter Burgosian was, when I lived in Portland, Oregon, I was a frequenter of the atheist Christian debates back in 2012.
Yeah, I think you mentioned him last year. That name rings a bell.
Yeah, no, and I it was so funny, as I went to his events, I asked him questions, and then I debated Andy Ngo about, because I was essentially what it was like a deist or something like that. It wasn't Christian yet. And so like, it's so bizarre because in 2012, Peter Boghossian had all the answers. Like I'd ask him a question and he'd kind of scoff and like, you know, deliver an answer in a very confident way. Aaron McIntyre asked him the exact same questions this year. And he's got nothing. He's got nothing. It's kind of amazing. He concedes the point. He concedes the point that the universities are broken. He concedes the point that immigration is out of control. He doesn't have any solutions. He's kind of vaguely alludes to no possible disaster scenarios in a very slow and ominous voice, and then kind of passes the ball back in a contemplative way. I mean, it's bizarre. Right? It's actually, I mean, it just kind of shows you. I mean, like. I always kind of thought he was a little bit of a salesman, Boghossian, but I think he just sees that his ideas are completely out of time in this world that we're in right now, right?
I'll have to seek that out. It sounds very interesting.
I don't know how interesting. He doesn't say very much.
Well, but that in itself, though, because it shows that they don't have arguments for this age. And this is what my previous guest, Maven Politic, was saying as well, that the left is bankrupt, the centre is bankrupt, obviously the right is bankrupt, and also the atheist movement. I mean, it's funny you should mention this, actually, because when I was working on the millennial graphics this year, I listened to a lot of vintage atheist debates from from the late 2000s, Christopher Hitchens, Richard Dawkins, Sam Harris and Daniel Dennett. I didn't see any of him as far as I can remember, but Hitchens and Dawkins, loads of debate. And it was when they would do a speech and then or this kind of thing. They were going around America. There was a lot of it going on in the late 2000s. They were doing all these different events. And the thing is, it's not that I even necessarily disagree with the words that they're saying. I just disagree with the whole point of saying the words. It's silly. It's infantile. Even if what they're saying is technically true, like something like, the Big Bang, the evolution, or some ancient book, this kind of stuff, the catchphrases that they would bring in, and I think it's wrong that people shouldn't be able to speak about monotheism, whatever. It doesn't even matter the merit that each of their points might or might not have. It's the entire notion of deconstructing a religion and leaving people devoid of religious faith in their lives and in their societies.
Well, this is true with Boghossian, right?
It's not a good thing to do. You know, that's the point. So over to you.
Pardon me. I mean, like Boghossian was he's the person I know the best. He had this idea of street epistemology where you would reconstruct truth just by talking to people on the streets. What the new atheist actually functioned on was this idea that somehow through discourse, you could come to all conclusions. And I mean, you could see the problem coming from a mile away. A, you know, you can't discourse your way into morals. This is a great thing we learned about. I'm sure I really despise this person, but the streamer Destiny, the person most characteristic about of basically the post 2019, he basically did more to end the 2016 to 2018 era of discourse YouTube than any person alive, and you know. Destiny, he essentially argued himself into having an open relationship when everybody could see this was a bad idea. And still, it's like, well, people push back and like, well, he shows in this coming. Well, do you have sources to show that this is the case? And, it might be this way. All this rhetoric. And all it does is sort of deceive him to the fundamental problem that's right before him. And this is the same
thing. We should specify that by open relationship, we don't mean that he was occasionally shagging his secretary or something like that. We mean that his wife was having other relationships with men. And, you know, people's private lives are their private lives, but he's talked about all this publicly. So I don't think we're saying, he's done his own videos about it. And it does just seem absolutely crazy. You know, it's funny. I remember a Stefan Molyneux video called, I think it was called Sexual Market Value or something. And it was really interesting because I think it was about 2018, 19. And I downloaded it, actually. It was so interesting. At that time, there was no threat of his channel being shut down. But for some reason, I downloaded it anyway. And it was a young couple had called in. And it was a young millennial couple, a weak guy and his girlfriend who wanted to have an open relationship. And the millennial guy was trying to reason as... He was trying to persuade himself that this was a good idea.
Yeah.
And one of the things was that, it means that we'll learn more about sex. So we'll get better at sex. So it's actually, I'm benefiting from her having sex with other men.
So you can see that's one of the things that broke the New Atheist movement was this idea that you could discourse your way into truth and you could sort of question fundamental moral principles outside of a historical context, right? Because anyone who looked at history or female psychology as it actually is in the real world understands that opening a relationship, especially on the female side, is just a complete death nail. It's not good when it's open on the male side, but it's absolutely destabilized on the female side. She'll lose all respect for you. But this leads to the second thing that broke the New Atheist movement, which was biological differences between demographic groups of whatever variety they come in. I mean, everyone could see this. And I'm surprised. I mean, this is why another reason I sort of despise Destiny. I mean, we've known that this is, I like to say, highly probable. I'm probably understating that a little bit, but I mean, most of the evidence is pointing in the direction that there are significant differences between various groups of people, certainly men and women. I think we can say that with certainty.
And common sense would tell you this. It's likely to be the case. Why wouldn't different groups have different averages?
Yeah, but even when the New Atheist thing was coming along, like we were like, it was Charles Murray had hinted at it in the 90s. There was evidence building in the 80s. But you know, right around when Steven Pinker in particular came in, right? Like, and that's a person who I know has seen the harder evidence for this stuff. Like, they must have known by then that this stuff was coming. And the thing is I think that, and you could see Sam Harris. Sam Harris tried to kind of bite the bullet on this one in like a few years ago, where he's like, okay, let's see if we can just try to get ourselves out of this in a liberal way. But the problem is you can't, right? Because in the process of them kind of shoving this into the background, society has built moral principles that are in direct, like they've made moral principles based on this not being the case. And furthermore, they bet an enormous amount of money that it's not the case. And I'm not even using that figuratively. I'm not saying like mass migration is a bet, and it certainly is. It controls the future of our children in a political sense. But like the Western countries have literally bet their economies on this, that they're betting that new immigrants that come in are going to have the same productivity across their lifetime as a native born. So, they're betting on debt that sub-Saharan Africans are going to be as productive as Koreans and Anglo-Saxons. The probability that this is going to pan out is very close to zero. I mean, I don't know what could happen, right? But this certainly would be unprecedented. And yet our entire economy's demographic profile to support our social security programs is based on this bet. And I think this is just, you know, if there was a serious conversation, it would have to begin there, but no one wants to have this conversation, so we're not going to have it. And that's why we're in this vibe shift right now where everything's falling apart. And there's nothing that characterized this year was the competency crisis, or I should say the emergence of the competency crisis. This is going to be a hallmark going forward.
Before we get to that, let's tie up the stuff with the New Atheist and Destiny, because I think that's a very interesting basis for this conversation. So the New Atheists, that had fizzled out really by the time I started my channel in 2014. That was already something, it was a done deal, you know, that they were over. Wasn't that they'd been proven wrong or just, you know, whatever. Well, it's just that it wasn't a current thing anymore.
Can I add another person to the mix? Kraut and T would be the next person you would want to mention here, right? Because he is the predestinate, right?
Yeah, indeed. But the New Atheist thing had sort of become old hat, partly because Christopher Hitchens, I think, died in 2012 or something like that. So that
and the Great Awakening, right? Because it was very apparent that at the Great Awakening, it was very apparent that liberal and progressive were two different threads of thought.
Indeed.
And were radically irreconcilable.
Yes. And that started really around the same time as my channel, 2013, 14. You started to hear that the universities were really doing wild stuff. And then the SJW archetype emerged. And then a centrist response to that was, well, the right-wing response to it was the alt-right. The centrist response to it was the Crichton Tea type. So why don't you talk about that?
Well, it's interesting. So the originally we called them the skeptics because they literally considered themselves the inheritors of Christopher Hitchens. And I mean, Christopher Hitchens was the one they took after because of all the new atheists, it was the most apparent that Christopher Hitchens would probably not like all of these woke scolds that came out of the post-Gamergate era. And the idea was that they would debunk feminism like they debunked, I don't know, intelligent design. Is that what they think they got? They certainly debunked Scientology, but that was a pretty small fish. And so you have all these people who would you'd have all these people who would go out into the and then say like, well, now we'll just debunk feminism and then it will be over. We'll do an expose on it. And these takedowns were more fun than even the Christian ones, right? Because it's more fun to debunk hysterical women than it's to debunk like stodgy guys with glasses and suits that speak in Southern accents, because the women are always emotional and it's kind of fun to have the pearl clutching and all that stuff. But
well, especially when it's like that, the crazy women. The
yeah, of course. The
big the red hair, or whatever her name was and all that. Yeah.
I mean, yeah, they're still around kind of, right? And so what would happen? I mean, I think what immediately happened was apparent that the debunking was not actually stopping wokeness from taking over the culture. And essentially Hillary Clinton was going to be the new woke president if something did not change. And then Trump came on the scene, and immediately the alternative banner was some form of nationalism, which opened up a different conversation, which involved people further to the right. And this involved, you know, there are so many different parties here, but then the skeptics found themselves in a broader conversation with people to their right. And people like Crichton Tea did not like this at all. And while I think this is where horseshoe theory really came into effect, because horseshoe theory, it was very, very obvious from the beginning that the skeptics did not want to actually have an honest dialectic with the right wing in any way, shape, or form. Sargon was actually unique in this format, in that you could say that he was a little, obtuse. Some of these conversations, you know, early on, so I was to a certain extent as well, right? But he actually had, to his great credit, he actually had conversations and he actually tried to confront the issue. But what other moderates tried to do was they tried to sweep it into something that they could kind of dismiss.
Yeah, I think he was trying to do the same thing. It just didn't work. But I think also through sheer force of numbers, his channel was so huge that he eventually concluded that he doesn't need to take us on and defeat our arguments. He can just talk over us. And that is what he did for a few years. And I'm not going to ask you to say anything against Sargon. This is my opinion of what happened.
Sargon has, he had to admit he's kind of seen the light of a lot of issues, but I'm not going to relitigate all that stuff. I will just say the obvious thing is that I think that his engagement was much more honest with virtually anyone else's. What people like Crichton Tea did, and Crichton Tea became emblematic of this approach, he certainly wasn't the only one to try to do this, was to try to kind of use some slick rhetorical technique where you cite a bunch of sources and then say that science is on your side.
You get the academics to respond.
Yeah, exactly. And what the advantage of this method is that the academy is ruled by essentially leftists. So in order for people, the biologists, to do their research, you have to they have to put boilerplates on their theses, on their abstracts that downplay the significance of potential group differences, which is toxic to the university apparatus at all. They don't advertise this stuff, right? So you go to a bunch of scientists and ask them to assert that race is a myth. And they'll all say, yes, it's a myth, right? And what they mean by that is, like, the historic categories don't exactly line up 100% with the categories that you'd see in phenotypes. But the problem is that they're highly correlated. Right. And so when you break these things down to the data numbers, immediately, like, machines can see race, like AI can see race easy, right? Like, it doesn't, like, you don't even, it doesn't need to be supervised even. It can immediately see it just from a k-means test on a variety of metrics that we would determine to be relevant without, you know, would be obviously relevant, you know, to anything, to any, I'm not going to bore you with what, how machine learning works, but that means essentially that it's not being manufactured by the scientists themselves. It's being manufactured by the data itself, or it's a quality, emergent quality of the data. And so, but you could still get all these quotes from academics saying, like, you know, the groups don't exist, you know, men have as much aptitude as women in sports, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the Atlantic did this with men and women in sports. They got all these academics to say, well, we can't prove that men are better than sports than women, meaning, like, hypothetically, there could be a woman who's better at the sport than a man. But it's absolute gobbledygook when you look at the data, when you unpack it into actual questions, and when you subject it to criticism. And so, you know, what Grout does, I mean, you probably recall this better than me. I mean, he dumps a ton of citations on this thing and then just asserts things that don't really make any sense.
It was the epitome of wankery, where he would try to wow the audience with how much he'd studied and how much learning there was in this, and then look at these fools on the other side who really just don't know what they're talking about, just cowboys hoping for the best. I mean, it was so disingenuous. And then he would just go on to prove, well, he would persuade his own viewers, but he would demonstrate to the rest of us that he simply doesn't know what he's talking about. And he would make obvious mistakes. He would repeat errors that we've already addressed. I mean, that's what it was like. It was a farce.
When you look at the arguments, it was a farce, right? Because, I mean, ultimately the joke was on the right wing because they figured out a way to do this, and the way you do it is on streams. The way you make this Kraut and T stuff work is Destiny and Vosh. Because what they do is they build a large cultivated audience of people that are fans of the personality. And they just flood the zone with affirmations as to their rightness or wrongness in the argument. And so I mean, Vosh is a great example. I don't know if you've ever talked to him. I mean, he has this.
No, never. He would never talk to me. No.
For my sense, I talked to him once and I kind of rage quit on him. But
I think I've seen that actually. I think I watched that. Yeah.
It was, I didn't know what I was getting into. I would have, I was like really tired from work too. But it was, what you have is like the supreme confidence and no consistent position. Like you can't nail Vosh in on anything. It's like he's a socialist, but he wants you to vote for Biden. Sometimes he agrees with like these bell hooks, social justice points where everyone is racist. Sometimes he's against it and thinks that it's like it's all about the individual, right? Sometimes he's like Sargon from 2015.
Yeah, it needs to be in order to keep people on the status quo. I think that's the ultimate goal there, is just to keep people away from anything that would endanger the status quo.
Yeah, see, Sargon sold an argument. Destiny sold complacency. And Vosh sells complacency, but he sells it to people who are like, you know, far to the left or are on the whole trans bandwagon and, you know, taking hormone blockers and all this stuff, right? Like these people sell comfort and complacency, and their high point was the pandemic when everyone was locked down. And it worked. It worked brilliantly because you had the streamers on one end making like this zone where it seemed that everyone was on their side, even though the arguments were bullshit.
That's because their opponents were banned from the arena.
And that's the other end. Their opponents were simultaneously banned on the other side, right? So you had sort of like the principle kind of categorize, you had kind of, what do you call it? not the pigeonhole principle, but you basically were locked in on both sides, Scylla and Charybdis, right? And that's essentially what gave the internet to the left. And since then, the left has not done anything interesting, right? What has the left done? I mean, like, you know, was H, you remember H. Bomber guy back in the day? Like, he made another video on plagiarism, right? And so for about 5 days, everyone on BreadTube was whining about plagiarism, how it was the biggest problem ever. And then Christopher Rufo exposed the president of Harvard as being like a serial plagiarist, and everyone on the left BreadTube shut up about plagiarism.
That I think that was also because of that was actually because of the whole Israel thing as well, because she'd said something about the free speech against and that led to that. But the other thing that I would have brought in here is not because you said that live streaming is what defeated these arguments, and with Vosh and Destiny, they were good at live streaming.
Yeah, but not like we're doing right now, like Twitch live streaming, like continuous.
Oh, yeah. Dreadful trash. It just goes on and on, and that builds up an audience. But the other thing is things like ContraPoint, where it's very well-made videos and slick and artsy. And that was a big thing as well. I mean, I think that was late 2017 when that channel first emerged, if I recall correctly.
Oh, it was exactly the same month that I started my channel. I remember our first videos came out roughly the same time.
Really?
Now, yeah, they delete all of their, and they made a video about me back in the day, right? I mean, and it's they delete all their old videos, ContraPoints, because they always try to cover up their past. They had a whole career as a new atheist back in the Christopher Hitchens days. They completely destroyed that
life. I had no idea about that.
Yeah, the first video that you'll see on ContraPoints' channel is the one that made them big. It's the one where they talk about Charlottesville. Charlottesville is what put ContraPoints on the map. And they were kind of a big, they weren't bigger than any of us are right now, right? You know, they were a standard, you know, left wing. But then this whole video about how the Charlottesville, the alt-right is coming to destroy us. And
that was late 2017 then. My memory was correct.
Yes.
But well,
that's the last video that they left. That's undeleted.
Right.
They had made videos across 2016 as ContraPoints that were much more dialectical.
I see you're using the pronouns that... Is that politeness?
I use neutral pronouns so I don't get in trouble. I just say, I don't use their pronouns. I use no pronouns or plural ones. Just
okay,
as a precaution.
Okay. As a precaution. Yeah, I understand. I don't think that you've become a raging leftist.
I mean, we could say he, whatever. I mean,
I understand. I mean,
back when they first started doing this, they weren't even ContraPoints. They were Nick something, what's call it, like Atheist 317, Hitchens fan. Right?
I have no idea about this.
No, I mean, the ContraPoints, like cross-dressing thing, that was 2016. And the videos were a lot funnier and a lot better. They were engaging, too. They actually took on, like, ContraPoints and I had a debate in 2017, early 2017. And they had a debate with Blair White too. This was ContraPoints was a discourse channel, and after 2018, they became this weird kind of like drag puppet show for the left to soyjack over. It's bizarre, and the videos have absolutely no point. And ContraPoints visibly degrades and degrades and degrades. I mean, they developed a very obvious drug habit. And they look terrible, and they make one video a year, and they're making millions off of it, right?
Well, this is a thing. This is why I think that it was astroturfed, because it was huge from the start. So there's the prehistory that I didn't know about. So for a year, from 2016 to late 2017, it was doing atheist stuff, new atheist stuff. Is that correct?
ContraPoints was doing new atheist stuff in like 2013, like before the YouTube channel.
Right.
Well, okay. There was a YouTube channel before that was completely deleted. I don't know if anyone's found videos off that one, right? The one in 2016 was definitely an anti-Gamergate, anti-right-wing channel. The one where they're cross-dressing, yeah.
Right, and that's... okay, so that's like an initial attempt, and then the second attempt was ContraPoints, where it's... from late 2017 onwards.
The first ContraPoints is 2016. That's still ContraPoints, It's ContraPoints in 2016 to late 2017 is not trans, they're cross-dressing. They say many times, I'm not trans, I'm just doing this as a performance. I'm 100% straight, like, I'm just doing this because I think it's funny, right? They're much more dialectic oriented. They try to debate people. They make response videos to people. They try to take on the arguments and come up with counter arguments. They're much funnier. They crack jokes at the expense of their own side. ContraPoints from late 2017 is like a celebrity icon for the
YouTube left. Exactly. It felt like a product. It felt like someone, you know, the thing about, when someone gets an image consultant and everything changes, like their hairstyle changes, they're better dressed, and the way they stand is different, and so on. It felt like, and I had never seen that channel before, never seen the person before, but it felt like constructed, like this is a perfect way to respond to us because it's more slick and and so it will appeal to the types of people who would be in danger of finding edgy stuff.
So I kind of agree and disagree. ContraPoints was like the individual. They pitched themselves to what the left wanted. And what the left wanted in late 2017 is they wanted a trans woman, not a cross-dresser who is actually straight, a trans woman who fought the alt-right. That's what they wanted. And that's what ContraPoints turned themselves into. And then 3 years later, Philosophy Tube also turned themselves into the exact same person because that's what the left wanted.
Incredible.
And they had to be trans. They had to be actually trans, not like performatively cross-dressing like Idi Izzard from the 1990s. They had to be actually trans. But I think that they just responded to what the algorithm was like. They were A/B testing, right? They were like, oh, is this popular? I'll do it, right? I don't think ContraPoints actually converted anyone away from like the right wing. I think that they may have convinced some people to kind of do the whole trans thing, but I don't think that anyone watched a ContraPoints video and was like, oh, well, maybe not this right wing thing. I think Destiny actually convinced a bunch of people, and to a lesser extent, Vosh. But that whole...
Sorry, go on.
No, that whole... talk about another kind of weird person, Hunter Avalon, remember him? He was...
I've heard this name, but I don't know anything about the person.
He was one of these people who was hopping on the bandwagon of the anti-SHW content in 2015. And... he is like the literal personification of the NPC, and he gets on a stream with a Vosh. And when he realizes that the chat's on Vosh's side, he converts to leftism almost on the stream itself and just goes whole hog on that bandwagon. And like Destiny, he also lets his wife take on lovers on the side to the point where she left him like about 6 months ago. This is sort of a pattern. But you could see people like that kind of jump the bandwagon very kind of, I don't want to say weak-willed, but I mean that's what we're talking about, right?
They are weak-willed.
They are. Hunter Avalon is a weak-willed man, and for some reason, Destiny and Vosh, I actually think that Destiny and Vosh were much more manufactured by the establishment than ContraPoints was. ContraPoints was giving the left what the left already wanted. I know the audience for ContraPoints. I have ex friends who like ContraPoints and tell me at parties they like ContraPoints, and I have to kind of hide my laughter, they must. I know people that ContraPoints sells to. For me, Vosh and Destiny they sell to very, very weak willed men who don't want to be bothered with the difficult things that are talked about on the right wing or even the difficult things that are talked about on the left wing, right? It's kind of convenience communism, for lack of a better word, right?
Yeah, nihilism.
Yeah, I mean, especially with Destiny, right? Destiny is, I mean, Amazing Atheist too. He's on that bandwagon as well. I mean, he literally sells nihilism, yeah. Right?
Yes, and, but he's of an earlier generation, of course. I think he is still around, but
oh yeah, he is. Yeah, and he's in the same trajectory as Vosh is. He's the exact same personality type as Vosh, just born 10 years earlier or 15 years earlier or something like that, right? I mean, these are the same kinds of people.
Quite a while. And again, he fitted into the new atheist thing in the late 2000s, maybe early 2010s. But I don't know, when society is falling apart, all of that stuff just seems insane, completely irresponsible. And I think it's also true of Vosh and Destiny as well, but they managed to weather that somehow. They I don't know how that is. To me, it's just never been more obvious that society needs to change. Something needs to change. We cannot. This trajectory is just dreadful. It's destroying individuals, destroying communities, destroying nations. I don't know how much more obvious it could be that we're on a bad path. And I'm amazed at the ability of people like Destiny and Vosh to persuade people that we're not. We just need more of the same.
I mean, Destiny, Vosh kind of LARPs that he's a revolutionary, but he's obviously an establishmentarian of the status quo. And it seemed like he was being fed by various establishments. And I get ContraPoints was too, but it was more explicit. Like he got puff pieces done on him by like the New York Times.
Exactly. And that's why I say astroturfed, because that's how it seemed to me. It's like, my God, I remember thinking, if we got this kind of treatment in the media, we'd be massive.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's slightly different though. And I guess I'm kind of teasing a difference. ContraPoints was given puff pieces by like establishment media. Like, it's not like Mysterious. They literally got interviews in the New York Times. They literally had, I think it was The Atlantic did a documentary on them. They were being mainstreamed above ground. Vosh felt, and this is sort of an impression, that he was being mainstreamed by the Twitter algorithm and the pre-Elon Musk Twitter algorithm. He would frequently get trending with a few hundred retweets, like out of nowhere. His retweets would appear on my feed when I had one without me following him, with me having him muted. And you couldn't escape the guy for a few years, and specifically in COVID in 2020.
So what was his, since I was off Twitter at that, I got banned, my final sock account got banned, I don't know, the middle of 2020. So I didn't I saw the start of COVID on there, but that was that. And I just didn't want to start an e-sock account. So I left it then. And then 3 years later, got my real account back. So I didn't see all of that stuff, the worst of the COVID stuff. What was the position of Vosh on COVID and the vaccine and so on? Was he just saying, was he just echoing what the TV was saying?
Yeah, he was like, I'm trying to remember, but I'm pretty much 100% sure that he was 100% in favor of lockdowns and also revolution at the same time. Like, revolution with
money. Oh, God's sake.
But no, but the thing is, like, you're forgetting, there literally was a revolution going on with masks in the form of Black Lives Matter. so you know, it wasn't... It's insane when we think back.
Yeah, but it was an establishment-led revolution. It was an establishment-led revolution. It wasn't a revolution in the sense that people tend to mean by that word.
doing
that. Oh, what's going on here?
Right?
I think your internet connection might be bad, Dave. Oh, dear. Sorry, everyone. Is this him back?
Sorry about that. Yeah, I need to get a new house.
That's okay. So I said that he was just, it was an establishment revolution that was going on during COVID. It wasn't, you know, what people tend to mean by that word. But I do understand what you're saying, that Vosh, well, it's so weird, isn't it, that to advocate revolution while also advocating lockdown. But I guess he would say, well, that's a health crisis. So, of course, people should lock down, but they should also rebel against the establishment when it's possible to.
Especially since it's Trump.
Yeah. And, okay, you take it away.
No, I mean, this is this happens periodically. Like the Cultural Revolution in China was another one of these things, right? Like Mao had a revolution in the 60s against like the establishment, even though he was already in control of the Chinese government in the form of the Cultural Revolution. And he had all these crazy women like go around and like, you know, take shop owners out and like nail hats to their heads and call them counter-revolutionaries and all this stuff. This happens periodically, especially in leftist regimes. It's bizarre, but it happens. And I mean, this, like, it's kind of funny now we're going to 2020. The fervor of belief of progressives in 2020 was amazing. And when you compare it to these days, it's kind of funny. I mean, like, no one believes this stuff anymore. The left is totally out of ideas. I mean, I guess some people do, right? And that's kind of what's interesting, what's happened in 2023, is it seems that the establishment leftists, the institutional leftists, are having a hard time kind of keeping control over their more ardent young activist leftists. And that's created kind of a weird dynamic in 2023. With Ukraine, it was great because all sides of the left hate Putin. But when it came to other things, especially with the Israel-Gaza conflict, then the whole coalition started falling apart. And, you know, now we're where we are right now with the various scandals that have come up, right? And I think another thing really that's also happened is that when Elon took over Twitter, the left started leaving Twitter en masse. And so almost all of the people who are the standard bread tubers, they're either off Twitter or they're just using a bot to update their links or something like that. I mean, with the exception, I think, of ContraPoints, very few people use it regularly. I mean, I guess Vosh does, right? Or Destiny. But like it's fallen in popularity among progressives because they get the sense that they can't win engagements on it like they used to, and they can't control narratives on it like they used to. There's an incredible aversion leftists have to any social media space that's not transparently curated by their own ideology. And they sense that implicitly with Twitter. But the problem is that they had no replacement. So as soon as a lot of them left Twitter or disengaged from it, the establishment version of the left and the radical version of the left started going in different directions. And now you have where they are right now, which is at some weird impasse, right? And the weird impasse essentially is that their donor class does not want to support them, but doesn't have any place to give their money anymore.
And what would they even stand for? I think that's another problem. And Maven was, in the previous stream, was alluding to this, that the left doesn't seem to know what it stands for anymore. And again, yeah. The Israel conflict has brought that into sharp relief as well. There's a huge contradiction in all of this. Either you believe in nationalism, or you don't, in which case you've got to be against what the Israelis are doing. It's really one or the other. But if you believe in what the Israelis are doing, then you've got to also believe in the right of Europeans to have their own countries. So it puts them in a very difficult position.
Well, I mean, how deep you want to go on this? Because this was... I mean, the left, essentially, in its essence, is sort of anti-civilizational, anti-colonial, which is kind of the same thing, right? You know, that's the direction it wants to go in. That is the direction it was going in the early 20th century with communism. Now, if you read sources from the period, what happened in America specifically was that a bunch of people from the State Department got together with a bunch of academics and decided that the way to fight communism was to have our own version of anti-colonialism that would unspool out more slowly. And this is what eventually became, civil rights in one word. Another word, it would be sort of the slow globalist order that we see now in places like Davos, right? This was very much, and the idea is what the Suez Crisis in England was a product of this, right? We're going to unravel the old colonial empires like France and Britain, but slowly. And we're going to incorporate them into a new world order that's designed by us to be more progressive, in some ways more progressive than the Soviets, but in different ways and accomplished through our international banking system and accomplished through our international intelligence agencies. And this is how you have like the CIA funding people like Gloria Steinem, right? Because their idea is, well, we want to have our guys be like, we want to have kind of a hand in this direction that the world is going in so that we can control it and make it our own. And you could argue to what extent that was successful. Obviously, both sides of the party, the anti-colonialists who wanted revolution and who were getting checks from universities or NGOs, And then the NGOs and the State Department, they had an incentive to play along, to pretend like they were all on the same side. But they're not on the same side. The reason why they're on the same side is because essentially America has promised that if the logic of civil rights is allowed to kind of carry forward slowly and iteratively, then justice will be given to everyone. As Obama said, who's the quintessential example of this vision of sort of the globalist world order that is simultaneously deconstructive but not radical in the old Marxist violent anti-colonialist sense. The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And this is very much the vision. But the problem is that civil rights, and this is what I say again, the most important thing to understand about the global American empire is that in the 50s and 60s, when it was trying to come up with this alternative vision of post-colonial society to beat the Soviets, it made certain promises. I'm going to emphasize that word, promises about what a post-racial and post-religious society would look like. The problem is that without incredible levels of growth and wealth, that society is not materializing. And as such, what do they have? They have a bunch of people who are anti-colonialists, who've been trained to be anti-colonialists, that want revolution. And then they've got a bunch of managerial bureaucrats who want to essentially centralize everything and manage it inside this framework of protected classes. And that requires buy-in from stakeholders to maintain that. And I mean, I don't know. I guess like it can last because there's nothing to replace it, but I don't know what, you know, that's kind of the crisis it finds itself in right now.
Well, this, I guess, brings us to the Great Reset. And at least in the European context, this is the kind of stuff that that we saw in infographics from the World Economic Forum and so on, that resources would be distributed. The distributist. Rather amusing.
Well, I've learned from James Lindsay.
No, not from Klaus Schwab then.
No, James Lindsay told me that Klaus Schwab got all his ideas from J.K. Chesterton and Catholic localists in the early 1920s. So we'll take it from him.
That sounds rather unlikely.
No, it's ridiculous. It's basically him trying to do horseshoe theory on reactionaries. Yeah. And it was, I've never laughed so much in my entire life listening to a stream, but it, you know, we could talk about that, but yeah, anyway, sorry, I interrupted you, but yeah, I mean, well, the vision was that they would just.
Yeah. So it's all these colorful infographics, nicely put together, very slick. It's not like commie drab gray and all that. It looks really cool and modern and all this. But it's ultimately talking about systematizing society and resources and delivering the things where they're needed around society and greatly reducing freedom, greatly reducing the possibility of danger and risk, but also enterprise, especially for at the lower level, for ordinary people. So starting your own business would become very much more difficult, especially when you're up against massive corporations. Mm-hmm. So it's the world that COVID created or was on the course of creating, where the little businesses are wiped out And what's left is huge corporations operating according to the ESG code and very much collaborating, very much socializing at the same things at Davos and whatever. And they're all in agreement. And so if you're a billionaire, then you have influence. If you're not, then you don't. You're a very sharp divide between the billionaires and everyone else.
And this is where Musk comes in, right? Because
go on.
What we always misunderstand about billionaires is that billionaires have, like Kanye West was a billionaire. He is now no longer a billionaire. Billionaires have billions because they cooperate with a system. The second they cease to cooperate with that system, they start bleeding money unless they are very, very, very smart, right? Because if their investment, if they get disinvited, if they don't get cooperation from other companies, then all they have is a big wad of cash and an enormous tax rate that will eat it up. The way billionaires stay billionaires is they get essentially cut in on relationships and opportunities that allow them to invest their money and make money faster than it would be ordinarily taxed or bled out of them by ordinary cost of doing business. It's very easy to statically maintain millions of dollars, but it's very, very easy to get knocked down from that perch, as Kanye West has shown. And so this is why, you know, people wonder why it's so hard to get patrons. Like, there must be some billionaire out there. There's lots of billionaires. There must be some billionaire out there who's sympathetic to right-wing ideas. Well, it's because they know that if they step out of line and threaten the combine of other billionaires, then everyone's incentive. So, for instance, like, the class of billionaires is benefited by mass migration. For a variety of reasons, partially because it keeps labor costs low, but mainly because it allows them to keep on borrowing at low interest rates, because they're betting incorrectly that the new immigrants are going to have the same lifetime earnings as the native population will. So they can bet against that and get loans so they can then invest and get more money, right? So if you go against that, you think, oh, this is a bad idea. Like, I want this to stop. Hey, I'm hedged against it as me, Elon Musk or whatever. But the international class of other people are going to be like, well, that means the cheap money is going to dry up. You know, you're now our enemy. And I think that's the reason why you do not see very many, billionaires that have right-wing sympathies. Elon Musk, perhaps notwithstanding, because I think that he's positioned himself in a way that makes it very, very hard for the establishment to attack him. And I think he's intentionally done that. That's I kind of lost my train of thought, but
it's a very interesting whole thing that you were saying there. Because it started off with me saying, and what I was edging towards saying was that these infographics, the world of the web, it basically seemed like a type of updated communism, where the ordinary person, it's not communism as such. There aren't gulags. There is private property, even though they say you'll own nothing and be happy. I think that was figurative. I think what they meant was you won't own your own house. You won't have a car. It'll all be in subscription. So it's not. It's not communism as such, but it's related to it and spiritually very similar to it, I think.
You're not going to own your own destiny. You're not going to be able to break from the consensus vision of what it means to be human. You're going to be very much conformed into a certain way of life based on the availability of resources. It's apparent that they pulled back from that a little bit in the last year or two, probably because they've had to constrain the money supply in the face of sort of global inflationary crisis. And when they can't, when interest rates are high, they can't borrow money from the future. They can't as ambitiously invest in these programs. They can't as ambitiously invest in these NGOs. Is it apparent that they've kind of pulled back from the Great Reset stuff of 2021? I think 2021 was the height of that, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, obviously people still want to go in that direction. And this AI boon is certainly, they see that as their ticket back to this path that they felt was being brought about by COVID. I'm a little skeptical that they're going to pull that off, but I don't know. That's what they want, right? That's what they want because that's the only vision that they can see for humanity. And
yes, that's the thing. I think that there is no other vision that they have. I mean, it is Agenda 2030. I'm not well versed in the whole, that whole thing, but I just mention it to mention that the year, because you know, we're still 7 years away from that. I don't know what they're going to do with this. It interests me and scares me. But at the same time, as you say,
I think I know why it's 2030, though.
Well, it's Agenda 2030. You know, that's the whole thing. And it's been going, I think it was originally 2020, but then they delayed it to 20. It doesn't matter.
I would speculate it's 2030 because in around 2030, the American Social Security system will be completely bankrupted. And at that time, they're going to have to either print like an enormous amount of money, which will cause hyperinflation, or they're going to have to massively tax the middle class, which will cause a political crisis in America and threaten their leadership if it's not secured by then. I would imagine that's why they set the date at 2030 about.
Right. Okay. That would make sense. But what I would say is, yeah, as you said, 2021 was probably the peak of this stuff. Right after COVID, like there was the year of COVID, 2020, and then in the next year was the vaccine and a lot of talk about this kind of stuff. The central bank digital currencies, ID cards, vax passes, all of this stuff was being talked about by very authoritative looking people, and politicians, global, the technocrats. I don't blame anyone, including myself, for getting very concerned about it. Indeed, I think it dominated millennial that year. And then later they started the 15-minute cities concept began.
Oh, they're still going with that one, aren't they?
Yeah. But this is the thing. I think what they've learned is that, here's a theory. They're still doing all of this stuff. But they've learned that it's bad PR. It doesn't carry well into the public space. The public don't like the sound of it. So best to just not talk about it. Best to not have Klaus Schwab videos of him talking ominously to the camera. Best not to go on about the rights that you're not going to have in the future, the freedoms that you're not going to have in the future. Because surprise, surprise, the public don't like the sound of that. It wouldn't surprise me if they're just keeping it quiet, but still going ahead with it and maybe changing terms here and there, like build back better. You never hear them say that now. But in 2020 and 21, non-stop.
I mean, does anyone in 2023 think they've built back better? I mean, but this is the thing, like they have to, I mean, I don't know. I mean, this is always the question. Do they actually have to fulfill any promise? I mean, what do they actually need to maintain their power? Do they need to keep the Jewish middle class on board to keep power? Do they need to keep the American upper middle class on board to keep power? Do they need to keep the European middle class on board in order to maintain power? I don't know. I mean, all governments are comprised of coalitions of people that have to buy in. And if they become hard dissidents, then the whole coalition, the whole power apparatus will start to fall apart. And I'm kind of wondering what does the establishment think it ultimately needs to pull this off?
Yeah. Could you stop your webcam in this interface and then restart it again? Because you've fallen out of sync. So you're about 2 seconds out.
Okay, let's see.
And restart it again.
Is this good? Are you hearing me now?
Yeah. I'm hearing you, but it's gone out. It went out of sync. So anyway, it doesn't matter.
My internet's not the best in this location, but it is what it is, I guess.
Right. So yeah, what do they need in order to pull this off? It's a very interesting question. All I can say at this point is things look very different from, and feel, as I said, they feel very different from two, 3 years ago. Part of that is, and we haven't talked about this yet, is the Ukraine war, the Afghanistan withdrawal, and now this stuff with the Gaza conflict.
Do you think they're going to lose something from that? That's a good question, right? The Ukraine conflict.
Yeah. That just looks like a humiliation for America and the West, especially Britain. But the whole West, I mean, Germany, all of them were ardently for Ukraine and saying that they can beat Russia, which always seemed crazy to me.
Yeah.
But they went for it. And it hasn't. I don't think it's going to work. I think that Russia's going to get what it wanted in the first place and more than it was asking for in the first place.
Well, I mean, it's very apparent, at least from what we know now, that Russia is going to hold on to land concessions that were part of a peace deal at the beginning of this war. So so it's not going to lose those land gains it has. It's not going to lose Crimea. So and Ukraine is probably never going to enter NATO because it's an active conflict zone for the foreseeable future. So all of Russia's demands will be met. And what do we get? We got a bunch of dead Ukrainians and platitudes about how we bought them there so we don't have to fight them here. I mean, this is absolutely nuts. The Ukraine war is insane. The question is, how does that actually look what impact does that have on the West? If they actually stand up and say, you know, it's understood that we've lost the Ukraine war in the same way that it's understood that we lost the Afghanistan war, what does that do to the leftist coalition? I mean, going back to the original thing we were talking about, like Destiny and Vosh, I mean, Vosh was the biggest Ukraine cheerleader. They're cheerleading people like running up to tanks with bombs on them to try to blow the treads off. This stuff was just nuts, and they were cheerleading every step of the way. Can you walk that back? I mean, I guess who knows, right? Maybe you can. Maybe you can disappear this from the news. If there's no boots on the ground, maybe it can just disappear, and we'll forget about Ukraine, and we'll focus on something else. I don't know how possible that is. Maybe the internet's main utility is just preventing us from forgetting that these things existed.
Yeah, it could well be. As I said, there's an archive.org and all that. There's an archive everywhere. But I guess the problem is that Vosh's fans aren't the kind of people who care about this stuff. I mean, they don't care if he's been proven wrong. What are you going to? Are you going to persuade them? Are you going to say, hey, stop taking this guy seriously? Look, he was wrong about this thing. They don't care. Most of these people are thick.
Yeah, people did debunkings of Vosh when he came out. And it's sick. Anyone can do it. Like, anybody can do it. But there's no audience for it. There's no audience for that because that wasn't the kind of thing he was.
I shouldn't say they're thick. It's worse than that. I think they're dishonorable. I think that most people, the average, they don't care whether someone has lied. They don't care it's like if Vosh was revealed to have been just a complete shyster all along, I don't think his fans would abandon him. You know?
Do you know a hypocrite?
Yes.
So he did a much longer debate with Vosh than me. And what he did afterwards is he had the fans come on and debate him on points. And he would bring up the numbers and show the fans that he was right in his claims in his debate with Vosh. And the fans would say things like, well, I don't care. You lost because you look stupid in that moment. And that's why Vosh is the winner.
Right. So I'm exactly correct. Then these people are both dishonorable and stupid.
Well, they're absorbing this because they're perceiving this as an entertainment product. For them, exactly. Vosh is an entertainment product. It's not like him being right is not necessary for you to enjoy Vosh. Just like, you know, actually being a woman is probably not necessary for the whole trans thing to be fun. I mean, obviously there's people who do this stuff, right? You know, this is something that, this is a way of treating the internet and reality that's, the internet as very, very detached from reality. And this is one of the more disturbing things about these newer generations coming up, is that their ability to discern the difference is, you know, much, much, much more detached. And I don't know, this is gonna help the mainstream keep control over the narrative to a certain degree. I mean, if Ukraine is lost, then a lot of Xers and boomers I know who were all in for Ukraine are going to feel very stupid, and they're going to look around for something different. I don't think any of the millennials and zoomers are going to think like that. They're going to think, okay, what's the next new thing that I can hop on and get good vibes from? I mean, I know some people will. There are always people who really care about belief and all this stuff, but I think that those people are all going to end up on the right. This is something that's going to happen more and more, and we've been talking about it forever, but the right is going to become home to a certain kind of person that has that is sort of more invested in real issues the way we would think about it, and less invested in the issues of what's happening right now, the current thing. And
like, how about this seems like a good point. Could you exit the hangout and come back in? Or should I say
sure, yeah.
That's showing my age there. Right. Hopefully he'll rejoin, and then we'll, because the lagging is kind of annoying, I'm sure for everyone else as well. But hopefully it will be eliminated this way. And then we, because I think that was a natural break in the conversation going on there. So, right, here we go. Right.
Hello.
Yeah, see, you're great. Back. You're in sync again. Fantastic.
Excellent. All right. Excellent.
So that was a new topic that had come in. That's why I chose that point to ask you to do that.
No, it's good, because I think, you know, this is the new topic. I mean, the right wing is becoming the home of a certain kind of people, right? I don't know how to describe the kind of people that end up on the right wing. But more and more you see people and you see how they hold themselves, and you think to yourself, you're either going to be somebody who's completely politically apathetic, or you're going to end up on the right. And at least in America, this is the case where, to me, at least, it's that the conservative movement is moving in the direction of the, what we would call the distant right. Very, very slowly, but these old establishment figures, this is just not going anywhere for them. And increasingly people who don't like what the progressive world has to offer are just going to become right wingers. I mean, Mary Harrington would be a good example. She's basically become a right winger because she realized that the sexual revolution was essentially a lie in most of its promises. And you'll see similar things with this. The right wing is the only place that has honest discourse. It's the only place that cares about... I'll give you another example.
I would say Camille Paglia maybe as well, but I'm not sure.
Oh, yeah, I mean, she's too old. I mean, she's not going to like come out at her age and go, yeah, I'm going to declare for the right. I'm talking about the people who would be our generation's Camille Paglias, right? And 100%, like, those people who are thinking in that direction are obviously going to end up on the right wing. You know, this is there was a conference held in the United States by one of my online friends who goes by the name Bennett on Twitter. And it was a very inoffensive topic. It was a pronatalism conference. Just how can we get more babies, period, in the developed world? Like, everyone's invited. Let's brainstorm this problem. This conference was written up by the mainstream media as right-wing, and it was coded as right-wing. And only people who had, there are some leftists who attended who cared about this topic, but by the end of it, they were all aligned with the right-wingers. If you care about babies being born, in the developed world, then you are de facto a right winger. Like you're in our spheres. We're the only people talking about this. We're the only people trying to come up with solutions to this problem. And this is just the direction that we're going right now. Eventually, the left is going to be characterized by people who, I don't know how to exactly characterize them. Either people who are essentially client groups, who are electing into a client group, or who are who are performing that, you know, in the way that most bread tubers are, or who are kind of consuming politics as entertainment, or who are just apathetic, current thing people. And this creates something. The problem is that there's going to be more and more of those people, especially as the West demographically kind of becomes more and more swamped. But this also means that their support is going to be a mile wide and an inch deep. And this is sort of this sort of complements the whole Edward Dutton thing, where the future of sort of engaged intellect is going to be distinctly right and distinctly religious in that regard. It's something to think about, I guess, right?
Does that mean that you and I are going to be quids in?
Quids in?
That's a British expression. Does it that we're going to be rich and famous?
Well, one thing we've learned about doing all of this is that, you know, I think Endeavor said this on your stream, the mainstream right just takes ideas from the dissident right and they put their own spin on them and put them out there. And, you know, I mean, we've seen this with, Vivek Ramaswamy mainstreaming some right-wing ideas. We've seen this with Elon Musk mainstreaming some right-wing ideas. This is part of the natural process. I don't know if there's going to be a lot of money in doing this, but, hopefully there'll be some kind of survival for our collectives going forward. One can hope.
Yeah, of course.
What really worries me is that more and more the people who I think really need to be taken to task are the conservatives, are the James Lindsay types. These people exist just to appeal to a certain kind of person that would ordinarily be looking at the genuine right wing. And they're being convinced that they need to get back on the libertarian bandwagon. And I noticed them a lot in the last 2 weeks, like this huge horde of libertarians is showing up out of nowhere. Like it's like 2020 never happened. I don't exactly know what's going to come of this, but,
Do you think there's going to be a libertarian resurgence?
Oh, there can't be. There can't be a genuine one. 2020 was the last year anyone took libertarian seriously. What I worry about is that they're going to kind of sit. Like James Lindsay is a great example. James Lindsay doesn't do debates. He's exited the dialectic completely. Wokel Distance, who's sort of a colleague of James Lindsay, a very similar figure. He did a debate with me, and
he did. I saw that one. It was great.
He had no answers to anything, right? He had no answers to anything.
He had so many words, though. I mean, he would spend ages saying fucking nothing.
Yeah, citing this source, citing that source. I mean, and then they can't answer basic questions too. I mean, the basic question about how you define posterity and nationhood and. The big thing is that right now the what's dangerous about James Lindsay is that, you know, Mark Ruffo, right? I'll give some background to this deck because this is the most critical thing in 2024, is how much of the pieces can we pick up from this crisis that's engulfed Western society and increasingly the left. So right now, Chris Ruffo, I deeply respect him, his work, but he's going all in on sort of kamikazing into Harvard's credibility. I don't like this because I don't think that it's sufficient to attack Harvard to get anything that we can use going forward, but that's his shtick. And it's working because a lot of Harvard's funders or benefactors or patrons are of a particular ethnicity that is currently feeling very, very on the outs from the left. They do not like what's going on with this Israel-Gaza conflict. They do not like the fact that they're suddenly the bad guys in all of this. And all the blind eyes that they've turned to other intellectuals that were cousins and third cousins removed, who they didn't agree with, but they didn't really feel a need to interfere with, all of a sudden that's becoming much more real. They are not going to give their money to Harvard. A lot of money is going to disappear from Harvard's endowment, or private endowments, I should say. Probably the ones it gets from the government will be maintained, at least for the present time. That money is going to get... I mean, the problem right now is that money needs to not get absorbed back into projects like James Lindsay and Local Distance. It needs to actually go to alternative institutions that are aligned to the things that we talk about and realities that we have to come to terms with. I mean, just, you know, I mean, the problem with James Lindsay's and Local Distance and stuff is that it's all based on sort of lies. I mean, they must know about these, like, what was so shocking to me talking to people like this and why I keep on doing this, like with these Adam and Stitch people and Local Distance and the Counterpoints guy. These guys have been in these spheres for 4 or 5 years minimum. They must know all of the questions that we are going to ask them, right? And then they must know, like, the analogy we do, like, so you support Israel, so it's okay that Israel's a Jewish state, so it's okay that they manage their borders, so why can't Germany become a German state in exactly the same way? They know these questions are going to be asked. They must have seen the questions that people like Charles Murray have brought up in their books, that Steven Pinker used to talk about in his books. They must know that these things are out there. But they have no answers for them. And their idea is like, we're gonna indulge this liberal lie because it's what the funders want to hear. But in indulging that lie, we know that we can, by definition, or by, maybe not by definition, by consequence of embracing that lie, we will essentially ensure that we will come up with no coherent plan for the future of humanity. There can't be a coherent plan. Obviously, you and I might disagree with how we might organize this, obviously, but you cannot organize a state without taking the reality of...
Yeah, could you switch off your camera? Because this
is the duration.
Right, I think you might have disconnected. I think he's lost his internet connection now.
You can't.
We'll work it out. Bloody hell. He needs to get a new router. Sorry, everyone. Okay, now he's come back. Right, so I'll remove that one and bring in this one.
I'm so sorry, Wills. What was the last thing I said?
I don't know. It was all roboting. It was right annoying because you were right in the, like, jumping into a new fashion thing. I said something like, because we've got to come up with a coherent plan for the future.
I said that because they're lying, they can't come up with a coherent vision of the future for humanity. You and I probably disagree with how much we would emphasize race in a society. But you can't make a new society without taking into consideration the reality of race, even if you want to have a multiracial society. Like, to make multiracial societies work, which I still think is a worthwhile project to look into, you know, in addition to alternatives that I think should be available to people, you need to take into consideration this reality. In order to make male-female relationships work, you need to appreciate the fact that men and women behave differently. And every single time when we talk to these people, they essentially ignore straight up realities because we have to keep the illusion of liberal post-civil rights order intact so that, I mean, I don't know what they are. I actually honestly don't know what they tell themselves. Obviously, people like Sitchin Adam are playing this stick because they want to keep the super chat coming in. And you can't acknowledge these things and still have this be a reality for you.
Do you not think it would be possible to, like, I don't know how much they're doing on super chats, how well they're doing, how big their channels are. One of the benefits of being off YouTube is that you just don't see this stuff. But nonetheless, surely they could start seeing this kind of thing without it endangering. I mean, if they start thinking, well, you know, maybe we should be having more kids. If we want society to keep going.
They'll say that, right?
Like,
I mean, I don't know about Adam and Sitch. I mean, Adam and Sitch aren't that big. They're like as big as you or me. I mean, even, I know you're no longer, and you got banned from YouTube, but you're way bigger subscriber wise than they are even now. What they rely on is certain few people keep on giving them money. And keep on giving them money for the same show, basically. And I think you could obviously say things like, well, you should really have a family. That's obviously, you know, everyone says that. James Lindsay says that. What you can't do is you can't imply that society needs to radically change and radically go back to a pre-liberal state in one way, shape, or form, because that immediately makes the entertainment product less useful.
See, I think that for a lot of people, and there's nostalgia for the 90s. I know you're guilty of that as well. I think a lot of people have nostalgia for the 90s, but also they as well, I think, probably have nostalgia for the 90s. And a lot of people, because it was when things were liberal. Mm-hmm. But people were still having kids and families were still mostly staying together. Things were mostly sustainable as they were in the 90s. Disregarding whether you liked the music then or you liked the films then, ignore all of that. The state of society and demographics, especially demographics, society was sustainable. If it stayed like that, things would be okay. Not perfect, but they'd be okay, be sustainable.
They can't stay like that.
Of course, that's the problem. You can't ever, and you can't go back anyway. There's no.
The 90s was built on debt.
Yes, that's the other part of it. Yeah.
And immigration is debt. I mean, we should actually mainstream this phrase, immigration is debt, because it is, right? Like,
oh, gosh.
You bring an immigrant in, like, let's get right. I mean, I just said you can't not take in consideration, but let's just say you got rid of race, like Poles, right? I mean, Poles are a different race, but like, you know, like a Pole coming into England, right? Like a Pole coming into England helps your social security system because you're getting them and they're paying taxes, right? But that person's going to get old. That person's going to have children, right? So eventually or maybe they won't have children, in which case they will take out of the system. So all you're doing by taking 20-year-olds into your country is you're essentially agreeing to an outcropping of wealth in the future for a paying in of wealth in the present. It's essentially the same thing as debt. And the 90s was based on that. The 90s was based on financial debt, on fiscal debt, and on immigration debt. And it was a completely unsustainable system because of that. And it was also based on a certain amount of cultural debt, too.
All
of the products we remember from the 1990s were based on sort of two fixtures simultaneously. And like, let's take Nirvana, for instance. Like, Nirvana is a great example of, you know, David Foster Wallace is, in my own mind, a very similar character. But I mean, you know, Nirvana is somebody who took a genre from the 70s, punk, and sort of mainstreamedize it and grunge, which, I mean, whether they invented that, it was a scene back in the day, right? But there, you know, and all these alternative bands, like, they're raging against a normality in the form of like middle America, which itself was a carryover from like the 50s and the 40s. It was actually almost a miracle that the baby boomers were able to recreate suburbia in the 80s and 90s in the same, in more or less the same way that it existed in the 40s and 50s, given how much decline our society had experienced in terms of crime, in terms of debt, in terms of the decline of working class jobs. Like, it's amazing. Exact loss of religion. It's amazing that that was resurrected for a brief period in the 80s and 90s. And then, you know, Kurt Cobain shows up and he plays a revolutionary spirit against this mainstream that is completely illusionary. I mean, like, this thing is if you rage against the bank, maybe that would be, you know, more of an actual rebellion. But by the time Kurt Cobain, well, I don't know if Kurt Cobain really raged against the nuclear family, but you can see this all throughout the 90s, you know, complaining about conformity and all those corporate guys, you know, with their, you know, they just want their suburban, you know, McMansion or whatever, you know, that's all of it. But it's an illusionary thing. You know, Morgoth had this great essay, like, why the midlife crisis was a product of the boomers, right? Right now, when you're looking at a suburban house with two cars and three kids, like Homer Simpson had. Homer Simpson was the quintessential example of like the idiot American who just, you know, went works, with the flow.
At the plant and his wife doesn't work, but he can have three kids.
Three kids, two cars, suburban house, what, like, and you know, you'd have movies like City Slickers in the 90s where people would have this and they would be in spiritual crisis because it was somehow not fulfilling. This is not something that millennials or Zoomers worry about at all. And, you know, we are entering that era where we could hypothetically have midlife crises. It doesn't jive. So, I mean, the 90s were a complete illusion. And you know, I guess I kind of miss them in the sense that I love the music from that era, and I kind of like the movies from that era, and I certainly miss something like Jeeves and Wooster, to go back to Stephen Fry. I mean, like, you could make Jeeves and Wooster back then. I mean, and you just can't have that anymore. You can't have – the other thing that was about the 90s too is that our ruling class was uniformly progressive, but they still paid homage to the old world. They still respected. They could make a movie about the Civil War and portray the Confederates as honorable. They could make a movie where you're rooting for the British Empire, right? Downton Abbey probably was the last of these, and I'm actually amazed that Downton Abbey even existed. They could make period pieces where women would see it and go, "Oh wow, I really wish I lived in the Edwardian era," or with Jane Austen, "I wish I lived during the Regency," or something like that. You could do that in the 90s, and now you can't recreate those eras. You have to recreate facsimiles of them, and in each
the bridge of inversion, and Darcy's black, and so on. Yeah, it's nonsense.
Well, I mean, part of it, racial inversion, because they're trying to there's some weird obsession people have with sub-Saharan African actors in eras when there would never be sub-Saharan people in Europe, right? There's a weird obsession with that I don't want to get into. I had this weird debate with a leftist recently. This is an aside, but it was this trans person. And I was talking about how I didn't want to ever have immigration should only be if like you're married to the person, right? And they kept on trying to like, well, what if a black guy pairs up with a Nordic woman? And like, they kept on emphasizing like the fact that it's a black man with like a Nordic woman. And I'm like, my principle has nothing to do with that. Why do you keep on like, they're obsessed with it. This is a weird progressive thing. Like, I'll never understand this thing, right? But they love this dynamic for some reason, right? They love inserting this dynamic into their little things, even their arguments, right? I don't know. It's funny, right? And
well, hold on a minute. What can you clarify what you mean? What they're saying there? Like, what's the argument?
Well, they're like, well, what if you have like, what if England were like there's a famine in Africa and you had to have 50,000 Africans come into England. And I'm like, well, fine, but they have to go back after the famine in a year. And I'm like, well, I don't know. Like, what if they, like, you know, they're imagining these scenarios where all of the African guys shacked up with like, and they kept on emphasizing the pure white women that they shacked up with. Like,
and so were they daring you to say that you wouldn't want that?
I think they were. I don't know.
Because I could just say it openly, yeah. I wouldn't want that.
What's so funny is I kept on asking whether they're married or not. And they kept on balking at that. Like, them being married would ruin it, right? Like, it can't be like Sidney Poitier from Who's Coming to Supper. Like, that dynamic is like, it's not doing it for them anymore, right? So this has to be something that's like a little bit more touch and go. Like, this has to be like the blonde Nordic woman is in a polycule with the African now, right? Because doing the marriage thing is that's giving too much ground to religious conservatives like myself, right? But it's this weird obsession. But like, more than the racial thing with the movies, I think that they just have to, like, this is Doctor Who too. They just have to convince you that, like, they will, that what you're seeing in the picture is not real, right? So if you go back to the 1950s and you see what the 1950s looked like, it's important to have Africans in the scene, not so much so that Africans be in the scene, so that you understand that you're not seeing something that actually happened. Because if you were to look at a picture of the actual 1950s in Britain and compared it to now, well, I don't know. I heard the 1950s weren't the most rich time in British history, so maybe that's a bad example. But the 1950s San Francisco, and compare it to now, it's obvious that the San Francisco of the 50s is so much more wealthy, so much cleaner. I mean, so much more beautiful. I mean, just look at almost all Hitchcock's movies take place in that area around San Francisco in one form or the other. And there are all these beautiful locations. I mean, you know, and now it's just these places are dumps.
Yes, it's a thing. And you and I can see that and acknowledge it and explain why it's happened. I think everyone else, the left, the center, and the right, have to come up with, they have to just deny that there's been a decline, or they'll say, well, that's economic factors or something.
It's not theoretical. I have relatives that live in San Francisco, and you talk to the executive or the city council member who's in charge of the Tenderloin. The Tenderloin is the worst part of San Francisco. It's just like covered in excrement at this stage. There's areas around it, like there's a donut around it that's nice that you can string. If people come to visit, you take them around this path where they can avoid this area. But when you talk to this person, they say, "Oh, it's capitalism's fault." Like, and they're the government, right? It's capitalism's. Capitalism did this. This is what you're witnessing with this. Part of one of the richest cities in America is capitalism in action.
Yeah, you see, the thing is, though, it's not entirely untrue. I mean, capitalism unfettered it is socially destructive, and that's what, mm-hmm. you know, the 80s, like, if you think about a film like Robocop, sorry, I've tried not to mention it in too many streams, but here it comes up. A film like that is obviously about unfettered capitalism, mm-hmm. how damaging it is socially. Not just the cyborg stuff, but that it,
no, I'd buy that for a dollar. Like, that's like, yeah. Everyone knows that line. I need to show my wife Robocop because I use that line a few times and she doesn't get it.
Which one?
I'd buy that for a dollar. You don't remember that?
Of course I remember that. Yeah.
That's like, that's the quintessential, like, capitalism, because not only are the criminals watching it, like, the ordinary law abiding citizens are all watching it too.
Everyone's watching it because the OCP corporate executives say it. And the criminals are say it, and I think the police allude to it as well at one point, and the criminals, yeah, and the ordinary person in the...
And the shops sitting.
Yeah, in the shop.
And it's just the most degenerate shit imaginable, yeah, right?
Everyone, like
it's
those, everyone's watching this show.
It's like, this is actually, that actually is the most brilliant, RoboCop's actually a brilliant, brilliant work of satirical fiction, because it realizes in a way that, I mean, 1984 kind of gets this too, but doesn't entirely. Even the people at the top are essentially huffing their own fumes. And this is true with World Economic Forum too. Like the World Economic Forum is huffing their own bullshit. They're imbibing their own propaganda. This is true with the whole, like the Jewish community too, with how it's handling the propaganda around Israel, Gaza. They're making propaganda to be delivered in 1997 because they've huffed their own propaganda. RoboCop just perfectly captures how corporate executives buy their own slop and then end up regurgitating their own propagandistic methods without thinking. That's brilliant that way. But yeah, I mean, and that's true too, right? I mean, capitalism is kind of responsible for it, but not in the way that, yeah.
There we go.
That actually should be on our dollar bill. I mean, but this actually gets to the kind of point of the whole thing. I mean, like what the right wing is it's going to be comprised of the people who say like, okay, I'm sick of being on autopilot. I'm sick of being ruled by people who just like, okay, we're just going to produce an entertainment product that doesn't interact with what's actually going on, like what the actual crisis is. Like I want to be ruled by somebody who actually has their hand on the wheel and is not acting out some kind of like fever dream from the civil rights era, which itself was propaganda cooked up by both our State Department and literal ex-communists who might also have been affiliated with the State Department. That's what we're getting with the World Economic Forum is huffing their own, they're getting high on their own supply of a drug that was manufactured 50 years ago. Come up with people who were ex-communists who were disillusioned with what Joseph Stalin did.
In fact, it's funny you say that because I remember with the COVID thing, there was what was it called? Was it Sage? I think that there was an NGO in Britain to do with the health, and it was critical during the whole COVID thing. Anyway, it was headed by a woman who literally is a communist, literally is a member of the Communist Party.
Van Jones is our version of that in America. If you know Van Jones, is he famous enough to be known in Britain?
No.
He's this black intellectual that they bring on to complain about white people. He did this, did he do White Lash? Was that his book? I don't know.
One of these intellectuals.
Oh, yeah, very much. So he's a little bit smarter than Ibrahim X. Kendi and Ta-Nehisi Coates. Like he has some a few intellectual achievements of his own, right? Ibrahim X. Kendi is just an embarrassment. I feel bad for the guy, right? Yeah, he's a literal communist, and he's morally lecturing you on these things, but, you know, whatever. I mean, who cares, right? It doesn't make any sense. But the right wing is just going to be the people who actually care. Like, do you want the human race to survive into the future? Because it's currently not having any kids. Do you want your countries not to be complete wastelands? Do you want... I don't even know how to save these things at this stage. And I guess that's what everyone's kind of banking on. Everyone's kind of banking on the fact that there's no alternative that's remotely politically feasible. And I don't know. I mean, eventually someone's going to have to stand up. And maybe that's what the right wing is going to offer. We're going to be the set of people who actually want to take responsibility for things in some way, shape, or form.
Yeah, that's a very good place to end there. Very nice summary there. Basically, someone needs to grab the bull by the horns, face the reality, accept, acknowledge the reality, and deal with it. Take responsibility for it. And no one seems to be prepared to do that. It's all asleep at the wheel, and just drunk on drivel that we've been telling ourselves for decades. And it's the drivel becomes ever more refined and ever more powerful by the decade, even as the energy on the ground becomes ever more, you know, ever worse.
This is also the problem, is there's a dynamic of the whole, I don't want to bring up the woman question, but we're packing society with
something sexist, are you?
Yeah. Oh no. I mean, we're packing society with very agreeable people. It's almost kind of funny. I mean, like the most immigrants to the country are, I mean, it's kind of actually like Islamic immigration into Europe is actually kind of unusual in this sense. Most immigrants that come to these countries are just, they disagree with whatever the establishment says, whatever the NGOs are saying that are processing them and getting them through the system. They'll just go along with the consensus there. And another population that's very, very agreeable is women. And it's like the blogger Zero HB Lovecraft said, if a right-wing government ever came into power, every one of these hysterical middle-aged women would swear up and down that they'd always been racist. How dare you imply that they at one point were not racists? And then they secretly delete their Black Lives Matter stuff or whatever. It's just the way, this is the way things are. And I don't know. I mean, I think the thing is that what we're saying is that these, I just worry that people are going to wait too long, and that we're going to end up with a lot more pain than we would need. People are going to try to support these people, like these sort of return to the 1990s projects that you see popping up everywhere. And we're going to lose valuable time and valuable resources because it's comfortable to say where we are.
Yeah. Indeed. I'll just close off this segment by putting up a hilarious AI image that was created. That is related to our discussion and possibly prophetic about the future. Or Sorry, Dave.
No, it's fine. I can't comment on it. It is a work of AI. Can't generate art, but it can generate irony, and this is certainly it. Right?
Yeah. Very very amusing image. Okay. All right. So we'll get to the super chats, and this has been, as usual, a fascinating talk. From
It's always good to. Yeah. I'm sorry about the technical issues, everyone. It's I really need to get a better setup here, and people constantly give me shit over it.
I can imagine the kind of thing. I need to get a new phone, and I dread it because I know it's going to be a lot of bloody upheaval. And but I have to do it because I want to do Twitter Spaces, and you need to do it from your phone.
Don't you remember when technology was cool? I mean, before we get to the super chats, I mean, like I you get commercials on YouTube, and you see these commercials for like Xfinity Mobile, and you see all of like these dad characters like prancing around with their new laptops with these big smiles on their faces, and you're thinking like, I could conceive of being really excited about a new laptop in the late 90s and early 2000s, but now, especially when they depict men of my age being excited about new technology, I'm just thinking, these people look like complete dipshits. Dancing around because they have a new toy, you know, while their society crumbles around them. Like, your family food bill just doubled this year, but god damn, you got the new Xfinity plan that has unlimited Wi-Fi. Great. I really feel like a big man now that I have a laptop with more pixels in it. Since the cost to feed my family has doubled.
Yeah. There was that meme of, in a similar vein, it was a picture of Mel Gibson looking pissed off as some guy talked to him. And it said, my face when society is falling apart and some guy's trying to talk to me about sports ball.
Speaking of falling apart, did you see that Colorado's taking Trump off the ballot or attempting to?
I just heard about it in the last stream, yeah.
I mean, the Supreme Court is going to bail them out. The Supreme Court is going to save America from its own bad decisions. If 2024 comes around and Trump's in jail or he does not appear on all of the ballots, the legitimacy of this country is going to enter into an immediate crisis. The Supreme Court is literally going to save the managerial state from its own attempt to commit suicide in 2024. And I know it's always bad to make predictions about these things, but I feel safe in making that prediction that the Supreme Court is going to intervene and save the managerial state from making a very, very stupid decision that would completely destroy its credibility. And maybe that's a bad thing for us, but, you know, there you go. Conservatives and something, right?
Yeah. I should ask you, since next millennial, by the time that next millennial, the election will have happened in America. So what do you do you want to make a prediction?
I mean, they're going to try to stop. Trump's office is going to be the nominee. And it's just like a bet right now. Like the deep state sitting across the aisle. Trump, if he gets on the ballot, will have an over 50% chance of winning. Now, like, that's what I can say just from looking at the numbers, right? That's an unacceptable odds for the deep state. And it could be, and I've heard some people tell me that it could be a 60 or 70% chance of winning, in which case the deep state is going to try to pull something. Getting a name taken off the ballot in the state. Can fortification accomplish that much? If the election is going that much for Trump, can fortification hold it back? That seems doubtful. And so now what the deep state's going to have to decide is, how much credibility do we want to burn to keep Trump out of the White House? Or can we survive another Trump administration? And that's the decision they're going to have to make. I think it's more likely than not, like probability piled on probability, right? I think they're going to try some kind of hard fortification. And by hard fortification, I mean literally what is Colorado's trying to do right now. Which is a move that essentially is legal, but obviously discredits the spirit of democracy to do, and will immediately undermine the legitimacy of American quote-unquote democracy going forward in the next decade. If Trump gets on the ballot, I don't think the emotionally mature move is to let Trump get in and then manage him in office, which they've done already. But I think that our current leaders in the State Department and in the unelected government are just such hysterical. They're either too senile or too emotionally incontinent to pick the obvious correct move, and they will sacrifice credibility for the assurance that Trump will not, that Orange Man will not be in the Oval Office for four more years. So that's my guess. But, you know, who knows? It's the future, right?
Yeah, of course it is. And I was going to ask you to predict one step ahead of that.
Yeah.
If he does get in, do you believe in the prospect of dark MAGA?
Oh, no. The thing is, he can't staff the federal government. This is the big problem with the regime change we're having right now in this generation, is that he would have to go full on like Curtis Yarvin, like retire the federal government. And the thing is that he can't just like organically restaff it like the Democrats do. Democrats can restaff it because they've got a variety of people sitting in NGOs just waiting around to be promoted into various bureaucratic offices. The right does not have that NGO apparatus. It does not have the university apparatus to do that. So, but I do think that Trump wants to fire a lot of these guys. And so what happens then, is what's more likely to happen in the event that Trump gets in, is that Trump, the obviously the best case scenario is that they're able to keep him under wraps like they were the first time. A likely bad case scenario for them is that he tries to lash out and fire a bunch of people that he's not supposed to fire. In a limited sense, in which case the rest of the system is going to try to remove him or get, or in some ways get around those orders. And that will create potentially a political crisis. And I don't know if anyone knows how that's going to be resolved. Probably the Supreme Court will try to resolve it. Probably the Supreme Court's going to intervene and say, okay, well, you know, you have to fire this person. You have to go if the president says you can't. But then that's going to trigger another problem with how the federal government is going to actually make decisions, because it makes decisions through these unelected guys, right? And if they start getting fired, then all of a sudden their own little internal chain of command doesn't make sense anymore, right? And then the system goes from being a little schizophrenic, like it is in 2023, to being very schizophrenic. It starts acting like a DEI department, like just doing random stuff, you know, randomly doing things. And that might actually trigger the need for real regime change by actual adults who think a little bit more like Elon Musk and a little less like Trump, and certainly a little less like Biden, where Biden doesn't even think, you know, Biden's just a tool of these people. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, very interesting predictions there. Well, not predictions. Yeah.
guesses, right?
Yeah.
given how I've seen these bureaucracies work in the past, that seems like what they would do, I guess, right? Probabilistically.
Yeah.
I think though, overwhelmingly though, the most likely thing is that they will pull a few shenanigans. They'll lose some credibility and Biden will get reelected. That's the most likely probability, right? Because they have things that they can do to swing the election 5 points in their favor, 2 or 3 points. So if it's close, they can punt it. If it's close, they can take his name off the ballot. It's legal. It makes the government look illegitimate, but it does not trigger a constitutional crisis, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting time. I think you're right that there clearly must be panic. And I think, but it is largely a symbolic thing though, because once in power, he's already shown himself to be incompetent and just not cognizant of what he needs to do in order to get done what he needs to get done.
He's more dangerous for what he might accidentally do, right?
Yeah.
Because these decision-making processes, like, they've got vulnerable spots. Like, if he fires 5 people from the State Department and they're the wrong 5 people, then all of a sudden, like, the decision-making apparatus there, like, loses its core and they start acting like, you know, like a DEI department, like just doing random shit.
Yeah, just mad. Yeah.
And they become like a schizophrenic AI, right? Just those random things pop up in his head and they just do it. you know, I mean, yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is our system is sort of radically becoming immature and it will get there one way or the other.
All right. There was something I was going to say about that, but I've forgotten what it was. Okay. Well, we'll just have to wait and see anyway. It's just speculations. Someone said earlier, I thought it was rather amusing. He said the Dave and Woz show would be a good talk show.
Yeah, it would be. Yeah, you have the. Everyone knows you're an excellent interviewer because you listen to people and seem to pick apart what they say at an emotional level that I didn't really think about it that way, right? And it would. You ever think of doing an interview show, Woz, in addition to your live streams? I mean, obviously you do one every year, but...
Yeah, I do it once a year for Millennial. And the thing is, throughout the rest of the year, I've got my own stuff, you know, like, especially this year, because I'm doing Substack now, and that takes a lot of mental time and work to write an essay.
Oh, yeah.
So, I don't know, I don't know. Is it earlier this, well, before, like this time last year, I was thinking about doing a thing this year where it would be like a quartet of, I would have 4 people on and then I took to Substack. And so that idea just fell away. I really don't know. I like it as it is where it's contained in 1 month in December and then the rest of the year it's my own work. But at the same time, I do enjoy talking to people. So I don't know. I have to wait and see.
It is actually amazing, the whole Substack thing that happened, right? I mean, YouTube is like, it's almost a dead platform. Like, the video essay is dead.
It's such a shame, because it was an art form that emerged. And Morgoth, of course, cited your one of your essays from one of your video essays from, I think, 2018 as a seminal thing for him.
I was very flattered by that. But yeah,
I mean, I thought you would be.
That's what you, I mean, you were a master at that too, right? In a different way.
I spoke to the camera and it was improvised, but your work was very polished.
It was a little more polished, but I spoke to the camera and then I cut it up to put the essay together, right? So it was not like a Substack essay where I like do an outline and it's like layered and all this stuff with the text. I do love Substack, and it's the future of where we're all the thought on the right wing is going to Substack. But man, do I miss the video essay as a dialectic tool. It was so useful.
Yeah.
At distilling down points.
See, this is what happened when I got banned from YouTube, and before that as well, because there was always the threat of that was going to happen. And then it finally did happen. And I just felt there's no point putting, because it takes a lot of effort to make a proper video like that, all the editing and everything. And it's worth it when you're on YouTube and when there's no shadow banning going on, because you get back roughly what you put into it.
Back in the day, you certainly did, right? Yeah, because your videos could go viral.
That's what I mean, yeah. So it was worth the effort and time that it took to make one of those. But when you're on Odyssey and BitChute and Rumble, Telegram, you don't get back what you put into it. So you know, that's why I changed once I got banned from YouTube. I just, the gram, because it was a different format that worked for what I could now do and the audience that I now had. It wasn't addressing the public anymore, because there's no point. I can't reach them.
So you're not reaching the public. Like, this is probably, you recognize this too. I mean, maybe you didn't, because this is a more recent development. When I made videos back in the day, they could go viral. Now, like, my viewers haven't really decreased. Like, the same, it's always at least 10K people view me, and then less than 30K people view me. That's always, I know it's always the same people, right? It's always the same people.
The algorithm is suppressing you.
And my wife asked me, like, when was the last time you had something go viral? And I'm like, not in the last 2 years. And I'm not like, was that a decline in your quality? I don't think any, like, Morgoth, I don't know how he does this. He just nails bangers. He has like three absolute bangers every year, you know, reliably. He hasn't had a video go viral on YouTube. It's just impossible to get a right-wing video essay to go viral. And so the way you get your views is streaming, but you know, that's not as good, right? It's not the same thing.
It's not the same thing. What I would say is I think that the live stream, and I'm not just saying this because I'm on Millennial right now, I think that the live stream is a completely different thing, but it can be just as interesting. It's not nearly as polished as a proper video essay, but it's but I do enjoy it. And even with solo people, I remember when Dave Cullen would occasionally when he's just chatting to the camera in his car or something. I used to really enjoy those videos more than I enjoyed his polished videos. And then it's also the same with you. I used to enjoy when you would just chat to the audience and to the camera, to the microphone.
My monthly, bi-monthly podcasts are literally how I used to make videos. Like, I used to just do that and then cut it up into an essay. That's what all my old videos before my child was born were just that, right? Now my polished videos are literally just Substack essays that I read into the camera, right? Now, a lot of people don't like that, but that's just how it is in text, right? Things don't work in text that they work in like live streaming. But one thing I will say definitively, I want every single one of those Twitch politics streamers to crash in flames. I hate
awful.
I hate Destiny politics streamers. I hate them all. I hate counterpoints in particular. I dislike this man. I debated him, and I lost my temper at the guy. I hate this entire genre of people. It is. I don't know. I can't even put my finger on what's so bad about it. I just despise it. It's something deeply dishonest about what it is.
Oh, for sure, for sure. But yeah, my point that I was making there about when I started doing the grammar and all that is simply that you adapt to what you have to adapt, because if you kept struggling on making video essays when you're not getting the return, it would wear you. It would demoralize you. It would certainly demoralize me. And people do say this. I mean, other people have said the same, that it's just, yeah, they're either banned from YouTube and there's, or they're still there, but they're shadow banned. So it's just not the same thing anymore. I mean, YouTube, it's amazing when you think about this. They've deleted a lot of material, in effect. I know it still exists on a server somewhere, but the public can't find it. They'll never see my videos again. So it's gone. It's what its memory hold. But they've also killed what that collectively added up to, and a sort of ecosystem that of intellectual activity, discourse. And a lot of it, you know, wasn't Hegel or something, but it was interesting, and it was honest observations of the world in the 2010s. And it's gone. And there's no equivalent for the 2020s. It doesn't, you know, we talk about it elsewhere. Not on YouTube anymore,
you know.
And so it's like they've switched off this source of material, that great material that would have been great of great historical interest as well.
The overused word dialectic is what I always associate with the spirit of what you're talking about, right? The exchange of ideas in an organic process that leads to something of a synthesis, right? You know, debates are stupid, but I actually like them because it allows, like, I want to be able to test the will of, like, the emotions. Like, I like encountering a bread tuber and then realizing that they're obsessed with this pairing of, like, a Nordic woman with an African man for some strange reason, right? Even though they're neither, right? There's something to be said, like, we would benefit. But if a right winger just walks into a room and talks to a modern day left winger, that sort of spirit, that dialectic, immediately leads people to see, okay, you actually have an idea and the other person is putting on a performance. And that is what we need to communicate to people. YouTube's certainly not the place for that, because our enemies are never going to essentially agree to that. And the algorithm in YouTube is designed now to not allow that. Although Twitter is oddly kind of becoming that, but maybe I'm
I could move on to that. I mean, we've already gone longer than I thought we would. But Twitter, and we've talked about it before on Millennial and previous episodes here. But I do wonder if it's going to be like, it's a weird reenactment of 2015-16 just now. Yeah. And it feels like Twitter could be the equivalent of YouTube then, where
it's open, but it's not as magical, you know.
No, it's not as magical. I mean, Spaces is good. See, you know, when they got rid of Google Hangouts, whenever that was, 2019-18, that was like a harbinger. It's like this era is over, because that was the tool that everyone was using, you know, to do all of that. And I liked it. I had fondness for it because it was rough and ready. Nice. But anyway, so I can see Twitter being an equivalent. The difference is that in 2015, lefties were still talking to us.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. I mean, there was actually an interesting hangout that I downloaded at the time. Again, another rare download. Between Sargon and this SJW. And I can use that term unironically because it was 2015. She was literally.
We call them Wilkies these days.
Yeah. What was her name? Jenny Goodchild. You never hear about her anymore, and maybe didn't at the time either. But she did this ridiculously long hangout with Sargon. It's like 5 hours or something, and it interested me because I could, and this I guess I'm sort of affirming horseshoe theory here. I could sort of identify with her. She was talking about a vision for society, whereas he wasn't. And he was talking about individual rights and the consequences be damned kind of thing. So I could understand. It made me think, is there room here for some sort of dialogue with these people? You know, that never happened. But my point is, the left today see us as completely toxic. I mean, you do seem to have quite a lot of luck in getting them to interact with you. Even Vosh, and of course, Adam and Sitch.
Well, that was back when Vosh was debating.
I couldn't
get Vosh on now, and Adam and Sitch is never going to have me back. They don't want me. I asked him any like hard questions.
See, I remember seeing Destiny debating someone, and they said something like, I've forgotten what it was, but let's just say this as an example. It was something like, well, I believe in Western civilization. We need such and such in order to save Western civilization. Something like that. And Destiny replied, define civilization.
Exactly, so right.
Now, I can't remember if that was the word that he asked them to define. It was just something of that ilk. So this is what you do. You get them. I mean, I would just say to them, no, I'm not going to define civilization. That's what I would do now. I would just be aggressive. I'd say, nope, if you're going to be that immature and retarded that you're going to pretend not to understand that word, get fucked. Fuck off. Because you're just wasting everyone's
time. They don't respect it either. You know, and the whole thing with Vosh, like, he asked me to define this and that, and then I asked him to define racism, and he gave me one definition, and then he changed it like 15 minutes later. They don't respect this. They change, they Martin Bailey all over the place. It's all a linguistic game, which is why you can watch hours and hours of Destiny and never, ever have a Destiny. There's no Destiny worldview. There's no Destiny ethical system. There's just a variety of ethical systems Destiny adopts to look good in any given stream.
In order to win a given debate. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Grown men shouldn't behave like that.
Grown men also shouldn't let their women sleep with other guys, but
of course, of course. But leaving his personal life aside, it's so indicative that of a childish mentality. And again, it's as if society isn't falling apart around us. You know, do you really think that we have the luxury to play these games? I mean, I don't know. See, Rotherham is the thing that really did it for me. It's like, when that's going on, if you're fucking around, if you're pissing about pretending not to understand the situation, you should be absolutely ashamed of yourself. I mean, you should exit the arena. I don't want to Fed post, but
it's
disgusting that in that environment, when that kind of thing is happening, that's the reality. That's what the West has come to. If you're trivializing that and ignoring that and pretending that it's just fucking normal, then I don't know what to say. It's enraging to me.
Yeah, it's. I mean, the way that Destiny treats his politics and the way he treats his family, his marriage, those things are not separate. I refuse to believe that marriage is not like, it's like a personal life thing. Marriage is a political decision as a man. And if you treat it in an open way, then you're going to also treat your politics in the same way and with as little care. You know, I mean.
Yeah. I understand what you're saying. A parallel. Yeah, I understand. All right, well, let's get to the super chats then, I guess.
All right. Stop rambling.
Both of us. And I've got to stop ranting.
Internet history always brings it out, you know.
Open Borders says, speaking of 90s music, were either of you fans of Pantera? They were the only based semi-mainstream band. Dimebag Darrell had a Confederate flag on his guitar, and Phil Anselmo used to make pro-white speeches at their concert. He even gave a Roman salute at a concert in South Korea once. Bloody hell. I never heard this about Pantera. I do remember hearing of them.
Pantera. I remember hearing of them too, right? But I was more of like a Radiohead Smashing Pumpkins fan, you know?
Oh, they were heavy metal. I had it in my head that they were like a techno group.
No, Pantera is definitely like, I associate them more with like Guns N' Roses type deal. Like, Kurt Cobain had it out for these people. Like, he thought that they were reactionary. And I guess according to this caller, or sorry, super chat, that they were. Although I even that sort of beyond what I would have thought was possible in the '90s.
Well, I would imagine the Roman salute was probably ironic and shock tactics or something like that. You and I know what it was like in that decade. People were just doing stuff to be shocking.
And Confederate flags were not seen as like, you know, people put like iron crosses on their snowboards. Confederate flags in the '90s, I mean, it kept from the South. I mean, I had a Lynyrd Skynyrd album that had a Confederate flag on it. And those guys were all into that stuff. And these things have been declared edgy and untouchable in hindsight.
Yeah, they're politicized now. The Confederate flag, I mean, the Dukes of Hazzard had it on their car. And back in the day. But no, I wasn't a fan. In fact, I didn't even know what genre they were in, so I'm afraid I wasn't a fan of them. But I'm sure their music is great. Darby, does the distributors plan on doing any more Warhammer 40K themed articles or videos? Really enjoyed those. Thanks.
Sure, I'll do another one. Me and Morgoth both have a love of this pulp novel fiction called Warhammer that also has a miniature game attached to it, and it's highly reactionary.
But I have an amusing meme about Warhammer. Let me see if I can find it while you're talking. You go ahead.
No, I mean it's reactionary because it was made by all of these British history nerds in the '80s, and so they accidentally made it based in sort of the same way that Judge Dredd is based too. They made it a parody and serious. Yeah, that's it. Is that Henry Cavill?
I don't know, actually, but I just love the idea of a guy saying this to a girl.
No, I've on hikes, I've been known to relate Warhammer 40K to my wife because I gab during hikes, right? And there's a few other online husbands of women who also have a habit of explaining 40K lore unwittingly when they're not thinking. But I use the analogies are great because ContraPoints very famously identified as the main villain of 40K is Slaanesh, and as a joke against the Golden One back in the day, who's also a fan of the series. So Slaanesh being a demon, that's like a lust, like the lust thing.
I remember they had a little interaction. It was very surprising. It was like one of those, like a crossover episode you never expected. You know, ContraPoints and the Golden Ones. Very strange.
That video is deleted on ContraPoints' channel because they deleted all of their old fun videos where they actually interacted with the right wing, because that can get you canceled, you know.
Right. Okay. And, okay, Bob's Vegana, loved your recent vid on your MTG cards. I'm interested in basket weaving. How do I get involved? I'm in New Jersey.
You just DM me on my, I'm at GreenMan6, New Jersey is my state. So, basket weaving is a, in real life meetup group that we have, that's like dissident right wide. It's not. It's associated with any ideology other than kind of not being progressive. So I'm at GreenMan6, just DM me. We can't just hand out general links because we need to kind of ensure quality control. I'm sure you understand. I really feel guilty about nerdy hobbies, but I like using them as analogies to politics. And Magic the Gathering is one that I played since I was a kid. I didn't play it when I was an adult, but I kind of got back into it. And I was fascinated about how it came about. It was a cooperative between this Jewish ex-Hollywood guy and this WASP math nerd. And they built this and this also, this like ex-engineer who was, it's like the story of America, right? And they all had like these ingenious contributions to how to market this piece of nerd culture, but I'm not going to get into it.
All right. I'm sure there's a lot to it, but it's something it's surprising actually But I guess maybe everyone's like this. They've got one or a few things that they're into. Like in my case, Red Dwarf, Blake 7, RoboCop, Doctor Who. But then everything else is sort of an alien world to them. I don't know much about Star Wars. I don't know much about Star Trek. I don't know anything about Magic the Gathering or Warhammer. It's all complete unknown to me.
My wife likes Star Wars, so I have to like that.
Right. I'm sorry.
I never seen Blake 7. I need to see that. That's
Blake 7's fantastic.
I like old BBC shows too.
Well, if you've got to have a tolerance for, you know, very low budget TV stuff, but
I like the comedies more though. Like I'm a huge Father Ted fan.
Oh yeah, Father Ted's good. Yeah. As a Catholic, that's quite. I guess yeah.
Well, that's one thing that could only come from the 90s. It couldn't come before. It couldn't come after. It had to be before the sex abuse scandal. It had to be before New Atheism. And it had to be after John Paul II. Any other time you could not, that doesn't make sense any other time, right? It's one of those things, right?
Yeah.
And it's oddly international, too. It oddly was not just an Ireland thing, that kind of priest.
I'm surprised. I didn't know that it had traveled at all, actually. All right. And then finally, Extra Things to Research says, Merry Christmas. Well, and very generous donation, so thank you very much there. And Merry Christmas to you. Let me just check if there are any here. Ah, yes, there are a few. Okay, so Kataman said, the UNESCO statement, the race concept of 1952, stated that different groups of people do exist, but they are equal in their capabilities given enough education. There was tremendous optimism about third world countries in the 60s. Mm-hmm. Israel Ehrenberg pushed to reduce anti-Semitism based on lies from Franz Boas in the early 20th century. Well, there we go. I don't think anything there will be surprising to anyone.
I mean, this is the great irony, in my opinion, is that we can make multiracial societies work pretty well if we acknowledge some of these truths and built them into our system. You know, this is the great irony, is that this idiotic 1960s perceptions are going to be the undoing of the societies that, you know, would be more open.
Yeah, I can see what you mean. I mean, there was an equilibrium there for a time. Okay. And he also says, what do y'all think of this framework? Obviously some overlap, but seems legit to me. Elon is a techno-globalist, and he links to a tweet from Academic Agent. What is this? Oh God. This is a big graph with different things. Okay, I'll put it up on screen. I don't know if we're going to be able to make anything out of this.
Maybe I've seen it before, so I can recognize it. That's my hope, right? If it's like 42 different graphs.
It's pretty complicated. Hold on a minute. There you go.
Oh, come on. Yeah, we all know that there are different schools of thought here, right? Like we all know that neocon, techno-globalist, and third worldist, right? That's true. But look, Elon has a slightly different vision than does Klaus Schwab. That's pretty apparent to me. And so I don't know. I mean, we always know this, right? We always know that our elites have exploitable differences in them. And right now, the third worldists and the neocons are going to war in a big way, which we should try as much as possible to use to our advantage.
Oh, yeah, I certainly agree with that. It's an interesting graph, but I think we're too late in the stream and both too burnt out at this point to really give it the attention that it deserves. But it is on Twitter. You can find it on Academic Agent's profile. Mm. So thank you for that, Kataman. I'm sorry that we can't go into it in more depth. Christopher Caldwell argues that immigration is another kind of debt.
Yeah,
this was a few years ago.
I should have cited him. He's the original. Well, I don't think he's the original person, but he's the one who most famously popularized that.
Yeah. He says he mentions cultural infrastructure and later government entitlements associated with immigrants. Okay, yes, indeed. And I mean, I think this is a well-rehearsed thing at this point, that immigration, you know, I mentioned the other day, the Netherlands have, someone's calculated that the Netherlands spent 400 billion euros on immigrants, on immigration, since 1995. So over the last 30 years, 400 billion. And the idea that they would get that back from, you know, Somalians and Congolese and whatever contributing to their society is just preposterous. So, okay. And then finally, Smith says, Dave, can you tell us more about what is probably going to happen when Social Security goes bankrupt in 2030?
It's 2030, 2033. I think that's the time period. My guess is they're going to print money. I mean, what are they going to do? They're either going to cut Social Security, in which case the government fails in America. They're going to tax the middle class, or they're going to print money. But printing money is taxing the middle class. Like, the middle class is who suffers the most from inflation. So it's going to be a giant tax on the middle class. That's what we're looking at. And it's going to completely capsize modern financial systems and modern and governments. You know, a person who I really, really, really hate, Richard Hanania, recently did a podcast, an article.
He is awful.
Sometimes he does something good, right? I hate the guy. I really do, right? He looks demonic. But and he also is such a I hate people who kind of like they knowingly say things that are wrong so that they can look good by contrast to the reaction that happens. I hate when people do that. And Hanani does that all the time.
He looks like Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah.
That gives me the heebie jeebies. So please continue with what you were saying.
He did a podcast with a sort of fiscal conservative that outlined exactly what the parameters were just in terms of money. And the money's going to have to come from somewhere, right? And it's only going to get worse as our demographic system declines. So, but I imagine that's what all the banks are looking for, because all the banks are going to not want to lend these governments more money after the 2030s, right? And what do modern European and American governments look like when they can't get easy money from their own central banks? No one knows that answer, right?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. And it hasn't happened yet. I mean, the whole thing is based on that, on the funny money. So once that tap stops, I mean, it just seems that we're heading for disaster here, one way or another. So I agree. Wait until the dollar loses reserve status, and then there's the energy thing as well, the oil. There are multiple crises approaching, one way or another, as well as the demographic stuff. So I wish I could give people solid advice for what to do, but basically I think that you should try to look after yourself, look after number one, first and foremost. It's a horrible, sounds like a horrible thing to say, but no one else is going to do it for you.
I would try, don't be an individual. Build a network, build friends, build contacts. That's the most robust thing in crises.
Of course, I didn't mean to negate that point.
Oh, obviously. No. I'm adding my own two cents.
Yeah. I mean, we want to organize. That goes without saying. But what I meant was try to cushion yourself, try to bulletproof yourself against this in whatever ways you can. And, one way is, and as someone said, grow your own food. I think that's a great idea. This sort of thing, I think, might become, who knows, it might become very relevant to all of our lives. Okay. Well, I guess that's it. I think that's all the questions. So, yes, I think that this has been a very interesting stream. So even with the slight technical hiccups, it doesn't matter at all. It's been very interesting. So I hope other people have enjoyed it. There certainly seem to be good comments in the live chat.
Oh, well, I'm always glad to come on these streams. It's a highlight of the year for
everyone. Oh, that's nice. I'm glad. Someone says, don't sell the Warhammer content short. It has been a great way to talk to my teenage boy and his friends.
Okay. Maybe I'll do that. Maybe we'll do more of that. But it's a fun time.
All right. Okay, well, this has been great. So thank you very much. I'll be back tomorrow night. Let me see who's on tomorrow night. I think it's the... Right, there are actually 5 streams tomorrow. Although one of them will be short. The Cult Games one is just basically going to be an advert for their new game. So starts off with Godfrey Bloom, and that starts earlier than usual. It starts 1 hour earlier, so 7 p.m. in Britain. Then Cult Games, then I, Hypocrite, whom you mentioned earlier, Dave, then the Old Glory Club, and then finally, the Alternative Hypothesis.
Oh, wow.
So that's going to be a busy night. But I'm looking forward to it. So, I will see you all then. And in the meantime, Dave the Distributist, thank you very much for appearing on Millennial 2023.
Happy 2023. Happy Christmas.
Talk Excellent. Later. All right. See y'all later.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The journey must continue, but it needs your help. There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated.
All aboard.
Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him continue. Until next time, enjoy the journey and spread the word.